Leadership is not a mindset. It's a heart set. You've got to have your heart right before you get your mind right. My father-in-law, who's the greatest leader I've ever worked for, he says, you have to love them and then lead them. And if you can't love them, you shouldn't be leading them.
Welcome to the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast, where IT and digital leaders from around the world talk about their careers, their inspiration, and their vision for the future of digital business. I'm your host, David Wright. The world of digital business is evolving faster than ever, and I want this to be a place where digital business champions create a village to band together and help each other navigate the ever-changing terrain. Disruptive Innovators features conversations with CIOs and digital leaders from around the world, diving into their personal backstory, career, their current role, trends they've been seeing, and their vision for the future, personally, professionally, and otherwise. This podcast is made for people who are seeing how quickly the digital business landscape is evolving. Those who recognize that it takes a village of trusted advisors to navigate this ever-changing terrain. People who enjoy listening to high-level discussions surrounding what it means to be a leader, real-world examples of challenges faced, and industry-specific strategies leveraged to create exceptional business outcomes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.
Good morning, friends. David Wright here, and I am your host of the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast. And I'm excited today to be joined by a Disruptive Innovators veteran. He's been on the podcast. He's spoke at a number of our live events. My dear friend, Walt Carter. Walt, pleasure to have you on, man.
Great to be with you today, David. Always a joy to talk to you.
Yeah, man. I know we were recounting before the episode how when you've spoke at my events, when you shared your experience on the podcast, and I've actually had people who have been at the events and stuff like that come up to me and be like, you know what? That stuff that Walt talked about, I actually have started using it. And I was actually talking to you about how, again, some of the stuff that we'll talk about later, I've been implementing that. So anyway, it's just a pleasure to have you on again, my friend. And just to start out, right, to level set, and any of our listeners, we have an episode with Walt. I forget exactly what episode it was, maybe like 30 episodes ago. So look in the like 60s and 70s, you can find Walt's original episode. But for those of our listeners, Walt, who aren't familiar with you or your experience, maybe you could just share a little bit about yourself, how you started out, what you're up to now, just to kind of level set, and we'll go from there.
I've been in IT teams and also marketing teams. I'm a little bit of a unicorn that way. I've been blessed to be able to lead both the CIO function and the CMO function at three different companies, and spent about 17 years in those C-level roles. And then undergrad, I'm a physicist with a master's in administration and an honorary doctorate in digitalization and digital transformation, believe it or not. And then I've written a couple of books, did one about 4 years ago on change leadership. And really the idea of this current book and that one was I've learned a lot that I had to learn the hard way. It didn't come to me in the traditional training that's offered for project leadership or change management. I built my own toolbox, basically, and then went and found the right tools. And that's what we're doing in the new book as well. I've also gotten into this world of fractional consulting and helping companies with short bursts of hours to come in and do strategic work and really just apply some of these principles that I've learned with companies. I'm working with some really cool companies, big national healthcare company that was multi-billion dollars, many states providing home-based nursing. We've got another client that is a college that is having some transformational errors and changes that are going on. And then got a streaming entertainment network that has gotten me into the entertainment business. And I'm jazzed about that more than just about anything else I'm working on, to be honest with you. So that's the short down and dirty, but I've had a great life. I'm continuing to have a great life. And for those of you that are interested, I'm married for 36 years, almost 37, to beautiful Eileen Politti. I have 4 handsome and talented children that are all successfully adulting now, which is awesome. And I've got 2 grandsons.
I don't think I shared with you or probably our listeners, but I'm actually having number 3 February 5th.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm excited. Working on a new house here in Williamsburg. I'm very grateful. But anyway, back to you, my friend. I imagine the CMO, CIO background is helping you in this new streaming venture too, right? Because there's a lot of nuance to that whole world. Like, it's very easy to take losses and how you make it profitable. I started dipping my toe into the water and learning a little bit about that industry. Like, I was double clicking into like Pluto and some of the other like ones that aren't, not the Hulus, Netflixes, and but some of those other ones and like how they make it work. It's very interesting.
And then there's a lot going on in that space right now. One, I was told last week that, well, there's 1 billion companies out there like yours trying to get into streaming. I'm like, yep, I agree with that. No argument here. The question is who differentiates the best, right? And at the same time this week, we've got Netflix with a self-inflicted injury that's just bailing customers and canceled subscriptions. So it feels like the right time to be entering that marketplace in a way. You also see so many frustrated folks on the sidelines right now that are great content creators, but can't get a foot in the door. One of the things we're trying to do at Thirst Network is really try to bring some of that in. And at the same time, I think you'll appreciate this, especially as a dad. We want to make entertainment that's safe for the family. And we really want to raise the bar on the standard of quality of what the storytelling is. We've got some really interesting talent that is part of the portfolio, very well led by former WSB personality, big radio station here in Atlanta. Monica Matthews is the CEO and the visionary. Like I said, I'm learning a lot, and the marketing background's definitely helping me. It's definitely a big part of the value that I'm bringing to the organization is being able to think through, okay, so we got to go get some subscribers. How do we do that? What is that look like? Again, just having some fun there. And I'm not locked into a path where all I get to solve is mortgage problems. And I got out of that first company successfully as a CIO, CMO of a mortgage company, but immediately got hired by another company to be the CIO and CMO of a mortgage company, right? And then we sold that company, exited very successfully, and then a few months later, here I am back in another mortgage company, right? And I spent most of my career in logistics and supply chain, big airlines. I spent a lot of time in the big airlines. I'm ex-Air Force. I spent a lot of time running a lot of missions in the largest flying squadron in Strategic Air Command. So that combination of backgrounds you would think would have made me much more compelling in some other areas besides mortgage. But here's what happens in America, right? Once you get into a vein, people kind of lock you into that vein and say, oh, that's all you can do. You're the mortgage guy, Walt. Suck it up and live it. And by the way, it was very good to me. I don't have any arguments about that. It's just, I've always felt, but that was an artificial constraint. I can do so much more, which is part of why, you know, I do the books and things like that.
I've found, for example, that we're very active in the healthcare vertical. When we've done our events, like our live events, I've found that I get very positive feedback from healthcare executives, for example, when I'm bringing retail executives, banking executives, like this kind of collection of people. It's not just the same recycled air that they have at the healthcare conference that they go to every year. And it's all customer experience, patient experience. It's no, like, what about this perspective? We did it this way. And not all of it necessarily translates. I saw retail actually and hospitality executives coming into the healthcare industry because some health systems finally realize, like, we need to think differently. This is not working. And like, I'd rather have someone who had the track record and experience of actually pushing the boundaries of this, albeit in a different industry. And we'll make up the healthcare knowledge. We'll give him someone who know or her someone who knows and can fill in the blanks on anything else that's there. So yeah, I agree. It's funny, Diplo was talking about, like, and here's a musician right? So completely different example, but about how he won't subscribe to just living in one genre or another. And I think if you're a dynamic leader and you have knowledge that translates industry to industry, there should be nothing that holds you back, either by vertical or even like we just got back from the UK in Sweden because we're looking to see how our experience translates into a nationalized health system versus nonprofit private healthcare system like we have in the United States. And there are dissenters, right, that are like, well, does it really? And then it's about, well, sure, there's a learning curve with some of this stuff, but look at this. And then the wheels start turning and the heads start nodding. But I digress. I think this is a good jumping off point because I'm starting to think about some of the topics that I recently read and actually in your new book. So at this point in the episode, I actually like to usually ask what my guest's favorite book or literary piece is. And instead of doing that today, I'd like to, Walt, talk about your new book, which I, again, really appreciate everything that I've learned from you over the years, Stop Driving Behind Idiots. Very compelling or controversial title, not necessarily, but it grabs you, right? What is this about? So maybe just to start, you can maybe explain what obviously must be a metaphor and a little bit about what inspired you to put this piece together.
So the title is intentionally provocative, and I don't want to inflame people by saying, oh yeah, I've worked for a bunch of idiots. That was not the point, right? But the point is that you have these, let me back up and paint with a broad brush here. Overarchingly, right, as you look at corporate America, and we'll just look at corporate America, we won't go to Sweden with you just yet, right? But when you look at it, the employee experience is pretty miserable. And according to Gallup at the beginning of this year, there was 76% of all of the employees are quote unquote disengaged. It was the highest that it's been post-COVID, by the way, it was 76%. It's typically around 70, just lack of engagement from employees. And you start thinking, what causes that? And then in your world and my world, disruptive innovation, if you look at the statistics of project success or change success out there, the overwhelming number that keeps coming up is 70%, 70% failure rate for your big transformation, 70% failure rate on your traditional projects, frankly. Anything that is big and hairy and hard to pull off, we don't do a very good job. And now you go to the CIO conferences or the CMO conferences. If you're in my shoes, you get to go to both. But you know what happens is you get up and you see all these guys go across stage and then they go, oh, yeah, my project went flawlessly from beginning to end and we implemented it and we dropped $124 million to the EBITDA in the first year and it was amazing, right? You know, and so one success after another and then you're going, but where's all this failure that the statisticians, the McKinsey's and the Bain's and the Boston Consulting Groups are all out there telling me, if I take on one of these, I'm going to probably fail. The odds are not in my favor, as they say on TV. So I'm going, okay, what causes that? And in the first book, We Can't Stay Here, I was really looking at what are the tools that we're just missing? We don't seem to understand how to do big change, big transformations. What are the tools? And I found tools in that book and I presented them in a conversational manner and said, look, there's some great tools out there. But if you use the organizational change management body of knowledge to do your change, you're probably doomed. You'll be in the 70%, not in the 30% that gets it across the line. If you're in the 30% that gets it across the line, most of the time what you've got is an acceptable level of failure that we could call a win. We didn't get it all done, but we declared victory on it and we slammed it in. When you try to run your projects using the Project Management Institute's body of knowledge, you're probably doomed to be in the 70%, not in the 30%. And the reason I say that is because both of those bodies of knowledge completely avoid culture, tribal behavior, how humans actually work or don't work together, right? Either one of those, any of that is contemplated. They assume a fungible human that is a cookie cutter that you can just manage across any project or any change effort. And I know after living in the world of reality for just a few minutes, that's actually not true. The only critter on this planet that's squirrelier than a squirrel is a human. And you have no idea which human's going to react which way on any given moment. You have no idea what happened at breakfast this morning and how my daughter threw up on me and I had to change clothes right before I got in the car, blah, 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 blah. You have no idea. By the way, here locally in Atlanta, Chick-fil-A does a remarkable job of training this, right? They have orientation videos where they literally show you people walking in and out of the restaurant going, you have no idea what's going on with this person, right? That's why it's so important. Chick-fil-A, we treat everybody right. We treat everybody nice. We're welcoming. We're engaging. We're not aloof. We want to be a warm, safe place where the food is also good, right? And yeah, you know, I'm like, man, this is awesome. There's some tremendous capabilities that humans have, but it requires one thing that we do not provide well in corporate America, and that's leadership. And that's essentially what the book's about. Stop Driving Behind the Idiots is really about how do you get an organization of people to really work together in a way that helps you accomplish the goals culturally? How do you keep your culture from eating your strategy for breakfast, as they say? And the answer is you got to systematize leadership and you got to push the visioning function all the way down to the lowest level leader in the organization. I'm going to stop for a second because I saw you just wanted to jump in. So go ahead and jump in, bro.
Well, two things. One, I had this idea, you know how Chick-fil-A is closed on Sundays? If they did some sort of nationwide like truck or stand where it was called Side Chick, and it was like every Sunday they would just post up and sell chicken sandwiches to all the people who couldn't get their Chick-fil-A on Sundays. I don't know. Granted, it's only one day. I don't know if it would work, but I digress. But I love Chick-fil-A. I love the ethos. And it's funny, Wall, and timely, because I have my media brand and I have Disruptive Innovations, our consulting arm. And I've been talking about this a lot on the podcast, about how the biggest enemy, as we see it, to innovation within enterprise organizations is culture. And namely, like a culture of fear, right? Because if I have leadership that perpetrates a, we need this done yesterday, why isn't this done yet? People are afraid to make a mistake. They're looking over their shoulder. They're trepidatious in regard to their own decision-making. They're running down the hall to check with Susie. It goes up one ladder, down one ladder, up one ladder, down another ladder. The organization's not flat. It's just like, you cannot innovate in that environment. And even if I try, to your point, implement a solution in excellence, if I'm not addressing the root problem, it's doomed for failure. It's in that 70% bucket. As IT digital leaders, we've heard those statistics for years. And it's no surprise that you started the episode. And it's actually something that, again, I'm going to use this now. When you talk about the lack of employee engagement at 76%, or people that are dissatisfied or disengaged, and the failure rate is at a very similar percentage. The secret sauce for us, like when we really started seeing our projects go from, we're just a technology integrator that advises on and implements these solutions, was when we started getting into the minds and hearts of the people that we were working with, right? Where we took the time. And the tricky part about it for me is that it's often a grassroots effort. Like it takes, sometimes, like for an enterprise organizations, we'll have 100 conversations up front, 100 different stakeholders across an organization that has 50,000 people, because that's what it takes. That's what it took to enroll the right amount of people, make them feel heard and seen. And a lot of classic CIOs that classically mainly had to keep the lights on, and maybe in the past 5-10 years, they've been brought up more into the board for decision-making and included in more like kind of enterprise strategic conversations. My experience is that a lot of them lacked the emotional intelligence in order to lead in the way that we need to lead, and innovating in the type of way we need to innovate now. It's requiring a different level of connectedness. And personally, I had to go through a lot of work on myself in order to connect with humans the way that I need to connect in order to be effective in this day and age as an IT and digital leader.
That's perfectly aligned with my experience, and even my co-author, John Vineyard. Both of us had been through a lot of self-awareness experiences, right? How do you know who you are as a leader? How do you know how you're coming across, really? I've screwed this up so many times. I thought I was saying everything's going to be wonderful. And what they heard was all vacations are canceled until morale improves. And I'm like, that's not what I said. Oh, yeah, that's what they heard, sir. I'm like, okay, then let's fix that, right? How do we fix it? And the only way to fix that, by the way, is doing what you just described, which is I got to have a lot of one-on-ones. I got to have a lot of small focus groups. I got to have a lot of really candid conversations where people know that I'm vulnerable and I don't know everything. And I really want to know what they're thinking. I really want to understand. And I have said really from the beginning of my career, leadership is not a mindset. It's a heart set. You've got to have your heart right before you get your mind right. And my father-in-law, who's the greatest leader I've ever worked for, by the way, he says, you have to love them and then lead them. And if you can't love them, you shouldn't be leading them. And I thought, man, that is a powerful statement, especially for a guy in the nuclear missile business. It's a very powerful statement. But he's also responsible for the biggest and most successful operational transformation I've ever been a part of. And that was before I started dating his daughter. Just amazing leader. And one of the things that I've also learned from him is loving them is really difficult sometimes, right? Because people don't always make it easy for you to even like them. So consequently, you really got to go through that work. I've said over the years, the devil's in the details. I've heard that all my life. The angel can be too if you're brave enough to take yourself down in there where the devil's at. Got to go face the devil in the detail level. And without those conversations, by the way, you never find out what reality is. I'm going to do a little bit of a sidebar here with you, David, if you don't mind. I had an epiphany not too long ago. You know how sometimes you're reading and you see a word that you've known all your life, but you see it differently that day. I had that happen not too long ago. The word was observant. And I was like, wait a second. What does it mean to be a servant of the ob? How does that work? I'm like, what is ob? Ob, obvious. Obstruct. If you don't want anybody to know what's obvious, you got to obstruct or obfuscate. There's all these ob words out there. Man, this is cool. What does ob mean? Well, in the Latin, it means in front of or before you. It's right there. So if you're a servant of the ob, right, you're a realist. I want to be as attached to reality as I can be. Right? Oh, by the way, what's the opposite of being observant? Here's Walt's answer. Because if you're so disassociated from reality that you're a threat to yourself or to others, back when I was a little kid, we had these places that were safe for you if you were disassociated from reality. And we even called it a word that conveys safety. We said, we're going to put you in the asylum where it'll be safe for you, right? And you're still far away from reality. You're not a servant of the, you're serving something else. You're serving your fantasies, you're serving delusions, you're serving lies, you're serving a lack of reality. The further and further away you get, if you're a threat to the staff at the asylum, then you go into the special room with the padded walls. And if you start to really do harm to yourself, even in there, they give you that special white jacket with the arms that tie in the back. And so observant, insane is the other end of that spectrum. I'll also share with you just briefly that one of the things that you see a lot is even in a flat organization, what you have is there's the executive level. This is where leadership gets done and where the rubber meets the road down at the execution level, right? So you try to take out all that middle if you can, right? So that you shorten the communication gap. This is where reality is. Right. But this is where leadership is happening. And in our book, what we're really saying is, no, if leadership is up here and only up here, you do not have anything but a unimind organization. Everybody down here is paralyzed and cannot lead effectively at their level because you've disenfranchised them from the vision aspect of leading. You've forced them to just be managers, reactors to what has happened. You're living in the past all the time. Up here, you're supposedly living in the future going, what do we need that we don't have? Or what's the market doing? How are we going to adjust to that? Leading is a vision word. It has nothing to do with handling. Yes, sooner or later, you're going to have to handle some stuff. But if you're taking the vision away from your lower level leaders, you've essentially paralyzed your organization. So back to innovation, right? Innovation comes from having leaders that are going, oh, I know how to solve some problems, and I'm empowered to solve some problems at my level. I don't need to escalate everything all the way to the top of the organization in order to get it solved, right? But I do communicate all my problems so nobody's surprised, right? We know what the problems are and we're working on them. And we talk a lot about that in the book, right? As a leader, you need to know I've got competent people down there working on the problem. I don't need to worry about it. They'll solve it. They're great. They're great people, right? And they're here to be great employees. They don't want to be disengaged and disenfranchised. They want to be all the way in on a mission that they feel good about. And so, again, the leadership thing is more of a vision thing. We're going someplace we've never been before, and I want you guys to come with me. Come on, let's go. And let me make it safe for you. Let me make it stable for you to get to that change.
Not to interrupt you, but I don't want to lose this thought, because I also love what you said about not knowing, right? Or I'm probably misspeaking, but like basically what I heard was, and what is true for me is that like, the more that I've settled into the not knowing, and I've said this before, but the older I get, the more that I learn and the less I realize I know. And what I mean by that is just there's this vastness of knowledge. And I mean, in a more like practical or specific sense, like in any given day or any given moment, I have no idea what Walt just experienced. If his, God forbid, like his mother just died, or he just got horrific news about his dog, or it could be something simple, but like his, you know, levels are jacked up, right? Like, how am I leading to those individuals, right? How am I empathizing? How am I connecting? Let me just settle into the fact that, like, into the humility of not knowing.
I use a tool that I learned from a guy named Dave Snowden called the Kinnifin Framework. He's one of the sharpest, clearest thinkers I've ever encountered in my life. And he said, if everything was simple, then there's a best practice available already for that. And we've already solved that problem. And you just go grab the best practice and you run with it. But if it gets a little more complicated, right, it's not simple anymore, then maybe there's an emerging practice you can go grab, but you're going to have to think about it a little bit. You have to make that emerging practice fit your situation. What if it's complex? It's not just complicated. All of a sudden, and what you're seeing as you move around the framework is there's less and less of a discernible pattern, right? And then all the way down to chaos, where I don't know if there's a pattern here or not. What do I do? How do I probe and sense and make sense out of what I'm finding as I move through this? Simple is easy. Everybody can do that. Transformation, where do you think that fits on the Kinnifin framework, right? We're going to go from some known defined state. By the way, that's a bad assumption most of the time, right? That you have a known defined state that is your starting block. What you find as you go down the transformation journey most of the time is what we thought we knew is actually not true. But now we're going to go to some new place that we've never been before. And guess what? It's not going to be simple, and it may be complicated. It's probably going to be complex. It may even be chaotic at some times. So as a leader, let's think about that before we start off on this journey and figure out in those situations, who's going to decide what's going to be our decision protocol? How are we going to get through that challenge, right? Because it's inevitable. By the way, I love sharing this with my CFO friends because they all seem to think that I know to the penny what this transformation is going to cost. Can't possibly know that because I've got all these unknowns that I'm going to encounter in the journey. I'm going to encounter unknowns that are related to what we thought was the foundation or the baseline. That's not true. We found out some stuff. It's not as good as you thought. We're going to have to fix some stuff. We call it legacy technology debt. Right? We've got other stuff that, you know what, the people that we thought had those skills, they don't actually have those skills. We're going to have to go get some other people that have those skills, right? That's going to cost us a little bit more. Oh, we don't have all the stuff that we thought we had. We're going to have to go buy some additional stuff, right? We're going to have some new capabilities that we never thought of before in order to make all of this stuff work together with the stuff that we're going to keep from that legacy stack. How are we going to make all this work? We're going to build some bridges, right? So as you move through that discussion with the CFOs, most of the time their lights go off and they're like, oh yeah, I guess you're right. We can't possibly know in a waterfall kind of planning methodology what the total cost is going to be. But what we've got to do is we've got to make sure that we're always holding the line on the value of what we're doing has got to exceed the cost of how we do it and get there. at some point in the future. There's got to be a return on investment. We don't want to take a loss on this. When you frame the problems correctly, the solutions present themselves. By the way, stop driving behind idiots literally comes from another morning I was having on my drive in Atlanta, worst place for traffic in the United States. And I said, look, you know what? All these people out here at rush hour in the morning are not out here because they like to drive. And it's not because they like to park on the freeways. It's because they're going to work. And in Atlanta, on a regular basis, all it takes is one person with less than optimum thinking processes to screw up traffic for the whole city for the whole day. Because we don't have that many arteries. And if you screw up one, you've basically screwed up all. So one morning I'm coming into Atlanta, got to cut through downtown. This guy in a big SUV, probably about a quarter mile in front of me, is signaling he wants to move to the right. I'm trying to get to the left. Nobody's letting him in because it's rush hour. Believe it. He's signaling everything, got great intentions that he's expressing perfectly. Nobody's letting him in. He gets frustrated. He sees a little gap, and he sticks that SUV out there. The first car by clips him, spins him around. Now he's blocking three lanes of traffic. I'm like, oh, and I start moving back the other way from my original intention. And I'm going, what's going on with that? So later in the day, I'm listening to, you know, our radio broadcasters give us a traffic report every 5 minutes on one channel. It's that good, right? And so this guy said, oh, yeah, that big accident this morning on North Avenue on the highway, on the connector, it was because that guy was trying to get off on North Avenue, right? He was going to go across 9 or 10 lanes of traffic to go. They're like, no, what an idiot. Instead of driving up and coming back around. No. And that's where the title of the book came from. It's like, these guys are out here driving and they're going into our parking garages and our decks at our corporate offices. And they're making decisions in our cubes in our offices, the same they make them behind the wheel of the car. Oh, and it's not just that, right? You think about the people that you've been behind on the roadways that don't know where they're going, or they're distracted, or frankly, they're just lost and they're panicking because they're lost. You've also got speed racer out there. He's zipping in and out, and he's more likely to cause an accident than the slow drivers. Although slow drivers typically cause a lot more accidents than the fast drivers. And it's because they won't yield. They won't share the community roadways in the way that they were designed to be shared. By the way, every driver's manual in every state says slow traffic, keep right. Don't force people to go around you on the right-hand side because it's less safe. There's a reason for these rules of the commons, if you will. And so now let's extend that into the workplace, right? You've got people all over your workplace who are different kinds of drivers in the workplace, right? So you got some that are really risk-averse, some that are really risk-tolerant, some that are really consciously aware of where they are and where they fit and what their role is and what they're doing. They got it. They know what they're doing. I call those people self-directed team players, right? They know what's going on and they're happy to be there and they're doing what they do. You got a whole lot of other people that might, they might be new, they might be brand new to the organization, so they don't have that level of confidence. They don't have that sense of awareness and strength. And you've got other people that are confused. I got a message from this boss and a message from this boss. They're in conflict. I don't really know what that means to me. So there's this lack of clarity turns out to be one of the bigger issues that we run into in our projects and our transformations. Is it clear enough for people to get behind it and know with confidence? Again, keeping it safe, keeping it stable, right? The shape or the symbol of change is a triangle, a delta. And it's designed that way on purpose. One, it's because C was already taken, speed of light. But the delta is actually the most stable shape in all of geometry. Why would the change symbol be a stable shape, the most stable shape in all of geometry? Think about that sometime.
Yeah.
Because if you do change right as a leader, you're going to create safety for the people that you're driving along with you. The people that are following you need to know that it's safe to follow you. Otherwise, they're reluctant, right? They don't give it all they've got because they're thinking, I might have to cut and run on this guy.
Right. No, 100%. One question I'd have for you, I encountered and like, you know, with coaching from guys like yourself, Andy Lodato, Ron Glickman, I've had the privilege, Alistair Erskine, of learning from hundreds of CIOs over the years. What a gift, right? When I say it out loud, I'm just like, wow. Most of which are friends now, just like you and I. Such a gift, but such that I've got to use this stuff in my work. And there was a situation not too long ago where we had a leader who was over, and I started talking about this briefly before, probably thousands of people, give or take, in that org structure or that part of the org structure. And I actually went to another CIO colleague about it. Actually, the CIO of the organization, to be candid. And I was like, listen, I got this situation. I don't know what to do because this is going to be a game stopper. And I had to go have a difficult conversation with that executive. And the way my CIO friend coached me was, he said, try to come up with a few things that they're doing really well and then offer the feedback and then wrap it. And I did that. And then I also talked to a few colleagues about it and got their support on the matter. And I guess the way that this person was showing up started to become clear to them from the other like peers in on their level in the organization, and it changed. So my question for you would be, when we have these types of leaders, either as consultants that are coming into these organizations that are expected to affect change, or as peers, or maybe even the CIO who has one of those people leading different parts of their organization, how do you address that? Like, how do you stem that off? Or what are the beginning steps and best practices, if you will, to deal with something like that?
The best practice was defined by Dr. W. Edwards Deming as a consultant to Ford years and years ago in the 80s when he was trying to help them embark on the journey that led to quality being job number one at Ford, right? The turnaround of the quality of American manufacturing. And Deming's model, his frame that he set to handle that was, I'm not coming on site at Ford unless I'm walked onto site by the CEO of Ford. And what he was teaching there was the same lesson that Accenture and EY and all of the big consultancies have learned very well, which is the higher your sponsorship in the organization, the more likely you are to survive that leader that you just described. And if your sponsorship is not above them in the organization, then you're at risk.
Yes, that's so true. I had the political capital in that situation, and that was actually how I was able to provide real feedback. And they knew that I had the political capital too. That's very interesting. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It's about how do people actually work together? Who's got the power in the relationship? And there's a more jaundiced way of looking at a lot of the stuff that I get involved in, and probably that you're getting involved in too, which is you assume the worst instead of assuming the best. But let's just use that scenario as an example, right? I'm not surprised there was an asshole in the mix. We found him, right? Now what do we do about it, right? If we're not properly sponsored and we've got to go at it the more conventional way, then how do I win this guy over to help us? Is that possible? I have to say that a lot of times it is, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes you just got to declare, sorry, that one's a loss. We're going to have to cut bait and move on, right? As a leader, you got to be really thoughtful about, how did I get into this relationship? Is there a recognition of equal power? This is another way of thinking about it. I teach a leadership class, David. I've been doing it for years. And I had 8 modules, but on the very first day of the first class, I asked this question of my attendees: where does maturity come from? That's the first question. And then I shut up and I let people think about it, right? And then I might ask another question. How many of you guys in the crew here today have met somebody that you think is really an old soul? They're very young, but they're surprisingly mature. Raise your hand if you've done that, right? And almost every hand goes up, right? How many of you have also met somebody who was old, a lot older than you, but not really competent in the way that you think? And you might call them the village idiot or something. How many of you guys have ever encountered somebody that's like the village idiot? You're stunned at how immature they are despite their advanced age. And again, most all hands go up. And about this time, I say, so maturity then doesn't have anything to do with age necessarily, does it? What does it have to do with? I'm going to give you the answer. I don't want you to have to think about it too hard, right? It has to do with, how connected am I to you? The more connected that I feel to you, the more likely I am to give you a mature response when tension starts to rise. In our relationship, if tension starts to go up, if I value the relationship, I'm going to fight with you, not against you, to maintain the bonds of the relationship through the tension. On the other hand, if I completely devalue or I'm willing to walk away for life in this relationship, give you the Italian salute when we're on, I don't care about you. I don't care what you think. I'm out. So your maturity and maturity response at the individual level has to do with connection. How connected am I to you? There's some other aspects, and that has to do with where is power at in the organization, right? If I'm not really connected to you, but you're connected to the right people, I got to be aware of that. And I can't just disconnect. I'm going to have to do something else. And a lot of times that's where you get the passive aggressive stuff, right? I'm not going to be aggressive in responding to you, but passively, I'm negative. Only doing this because you're connected to the power source in the organization. This is where the politics becomes really important in a lot of these transformation efforts. So like I said, if you start thinking about, okay, so I want a highly collaborative, mature team working together to solve problems as fast as they come up and make sure that we're getting all hands on deck to come up with the best outcomes possible in alignment with the mission, vision, values of our organization and the purpose of this transformation or this project, then I gotta be a leader that understands all of this stuff. I just keep the equipment running. I'm the Maytag repairman. People only call when stuff is broken, and I never talk to anybody in between. I can't be that guy. By the way, I would suggest to you right now that in the current hiring of CIOs out there that's going on, and CMOs, almost any executive, if you're not thinking this way, right, about strategic, how do humans work? How do we actually get the most from our people? How do we stop this disengagement from happening? How do we get the return on investment in our initiatives? If you're not that level of leader and you're only on a lights on kind of thing, right? Oh yeah, I can get you some clicks. I can get you some impressions as a marketer. I'm actually looking for real dollars that we can spend. I don't care about clicks. So if you're not thinking beyond the limited stuff, you're not going to wind up in the role. Or you wind up working for one that's very limited.
Right. Sage-like advice for, you know, we do have a lot of CIO listeners. So, hey, Walt, I'm so impressed with all this. You know, so again, anybody who wants to learn more about, you know, leadership systems, you know, the importance of culture, Driving Behind Idiots was an amazing book. I took away a ton of stuff that I could implement. So, Walt, thanks for getting in. I know we went all over the place, but I think it was the essence was there, right? And so now we teased it. Please go check it out. We'll put the link in the show notes. And Walt, just want to thank you again for coming on.
No, thank you, Dave. It's always, like I said, no telling where the conversation is going to go with a brilliant mind like yours. Just did my best to try to answer your questions. But at the same time, I think the fundamentals here, as you pointed out, leadership is best in an organization when it's systematized, when you're pushing that leadership vision function all the way down and people are aligned and or tuned. Tune is a good word for that. And then I modeled a lot of this stuff from my background in the military, the most mature leadership system and leadership production system, the factory of leadership. I think in our military, we do that better than anywhere else. And team sports, I spent a lot of time playing ball in high school and college, and you always knew where you were in the leadership systems on any big team that you were part of. So as you start thinking about what could I do to solve that culture problem in my organization, if you're the leader, systematize your leadership, push your wisdom down and let people have their heads and learn. And then I think you also nailed it early on, which is let's cultivate this friendly, collaborative, we don't any one of us have all the answers, but maybe together we can get to the answers that we need to move the ball down the field. And when you're working that way as a leader, yeah, the buck stops here. I get to make the decision. If we can't make a collective decision that makes sense, I'll make the decision because I'm the leader, right? But sooner or later, that fails too. And better to have your team behind you running forward than not. And oh, by the way, if you're a leader with no team, then you're not really a leader, are you?
Nope, not at all.
Great being with you today. And for those of you that want to follow me on X, It's at Walt74, and I'd love to engage with anybody that's got additional questions. Thanks, David.
Thanks again, Walt. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We will catch you all next week.
Thank you for listening to the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future episodes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.